Are you ready? Okay. Hebrews chapter 11, part 2. We're only doing one verse tonight. And I mean, we could easily be 6 weeks in chapter 11 because it's a history of people who trusted God in our history, in human history, who set examples for us that if we pay attention and learn from them, will enable us to run our race. And so it's worth studying just for that reason. And it's challenging to teach because you want to tell everybody's story. He only gives one verse to Noah. And I could press on and start talking about Abraham tonight, but I want to spend our whole time looking at Noah. I'm going to read you selections from Genesis chapter 6, which is the story, at least the beginning story. And the reason I want to look at Noah closely is because Jesus used Noah as a warning for those of us that live in these days we're living in right now. And Peter did also. So after we look at the lessons of faith that the Bible tells us about and that Hebrews tells us about Noah, then we're going to look at how that applies to us. And it was a blessing last night. I felt like I wandered a little bit, but God seems to always cover for me. So we looked last time. We got as far as verse 6. We talked about Enoch. Enoch was Noah's great-grandfather. And if Enoch had not been snatched away, if God had not gotten him out of that stinky world that he was living as basically the only righteous guy on planet Earth, walking in fellowship with God, but if God hadn't taken him away, he would have been alive at the time of Noah for several hundred years. And that would have been something to see. So in a space of a couple of hundred years before the flood, God's destruction of the then known world, in that space, there are only two humans the Bible mentions that are righteous people that walk in fellowship with God. One of them God just snatched out of there and said, that's it, you know, I'm not leaving you here. I want you home with me. And Noah, basically what God said was the world was worse when Noah was there. It kept getting worse. We'll look at the passage in Genesis where God just says, that's it. I'm going to start over again. And Noah, you're the only righteous guy there is. I'm going to start over with you. I'm going to pick you to be what I start. And you and your family, what I start over with. So we want to look at this one verse. Before I read this at all, I want us, as we will do every single time, turn over to chapter 12, verse 1 and 2. Because chapter 12 starts with the words, therefore, which means what he is about to say, the writer of Hebrews is about to tell us, that what he's going to say is connected to what we have just been reading. All throughout chapter 11, people who've borne testimony with the way they live their lives, their obedience to God, things that they did that were borderline impossible and sometimes impossible to do simply because they trusted God. And because that's true, verse 1, chapter 12 says, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. I love that metaphor of running the race and fixing your eyes on Jesus, because the only way you could run your race and fix your eyes on Jesus is if he's at the finish line waiting for you, cheering you on. However, he's also running with us, cheering us on. And we talked last week. I'll probably say it again for the sake of those that just jump into the study of chapter 11. That phrase, witnesses, is not speaking of spectators. It's not all these famous people in the Bible and my grandpa and my dad and my grandma watching from the bleachers in heaven. That's not what the word witnesses means. It means those who have borne testimony in a trial. Those who have declared by the way they live their lives that God is worth trusting. By their endurance, by their perseverance, they declared that it was worth holding on. Remember, the writer of Hebrews over and over has been talking to these discouraged Jewish Christians and saying, don't give up. Don't throw away your hope. Don't lose sight of the promise that God has laid before you, because if you give up, you'll miss the promise. And then he sets out laying example after example after example, starting chronologically with the first human born in sin, Abel and Cain, and now he's working his way down. People live so long in these days that your great-great-grandfather could be alive for 100 years when you're alive. So the generations are remarkable. Another thing I want to say that is often hard for us to wrap our brains around is the exponential population growth that happens over a period of time. And the best example that I could think of without just throwing out a bunch of mathematical formulas is to look at when when Jacob and his family to escape the famine in Israel went to Egypt. And remember, Joseph was there as one of the rulers in Egypt. And Jacob brought his family down there and they settled in Egypt. There were, at wildest estimate, there were maybe 30 of them. 30 Jewish people, Israelites, in all of the planet. They were in Egypt a little bit over 400 years, 430 years. In 430 years, 30 people grew to 3 million people. That 430 years is half the lifetime of half the lifetime of Adam, two-thirds the lifetime of Noah. So if you get these guys that are living 700 or 900 years, and you throw the population curve in there, and there could easily have been a population of the earth equivalent to what is the population today. And so as we read in Genesis, I'm just going to read some excerpts from Genesis 6. You don't have to turn there. But there are some things I want you to notice. I'm probably going to make some comments on them. I want you to notice the state of the culture. I want you to notice the state of God's heart and mind. And I want you to notice the character of Noah. Before I do that, I'm just going to read the verse we're going to look at tonight in Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, verse 7. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, that phrase means things that have never been seen before, not just things that hadn't happened yet, things not yet seen ever, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which faith he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. Circle that word, condemned. It's a unique Greek word. And I personally think condemned is a bad translation, but I really can't think of a better one. So that in mind, we're going to look at Noah, who by faith did something unprecedented because he believed a promise of something that was going to happen that had never happened before. Now remember back in verse 1, when we're told what faith actually is, one of the things that the writer of Hebrews says is that faith is evidence or conviction or proof of things which are not seen. So the reason why Noah is thrown into this mix of people who are examples of faith is because Noah acted on something, because he believed what God said, even though not only was it not seen, it had never been seen. I think Noah's an excellent example of faith. So let me read you from Genesis 6. I'm not going to read every verse. But I want us to look at, once again, the state of the world in Noah's day. The world was pretty bad in Enoch's day. Enoch was the only righteous man in the world in his day. And he went to heaven about 60 years before Noah was born. And Noah's dad and Noah's grandpa don't seem to be any real stellar godly men at all. So it's remarkable that without the influence directly of a man like Enoch, his great-grandson turned out to be somebody who also walked with God. And I want you to notice God's heart. I misunderstood the whole story of the flood for years. Pretty much everything I heard in the church I grew up in was all about how mad God was. And I always thought of the world being destroyed by the flood because God was mad. And it's interesting that the record in Genesis does not say that. Listen to what it says. When man began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair, and they took wives of all they desired and chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not forever," I'm reading from the Amplified Bible, by the way, "My spirit shall not forever dwell and strive with man, for he is flesh, but his days shall yet be 120 years. The word flesh is a weak translation of a Hebrew word basar, B-A-S-A-R, which when it's used figuratively means erring or corrupt from the ways of God. Flesh as contrasted with like God. So I'm going to read it that way. The Lord says, "My spirit shall not forever dwell and strive with man, for he is corrupt." Now that word corrupt is going to be used a bunch of times in here. "But his days shall yet be 120 years. Circle the word strive if you are reading there through there. The word means to wrestle. So if God says the world stinks so bad, my spirit's not going to always wrestle with humans, that means that God's spirit was wrestling with humans up to that point. And I think that's important. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination and intention of all human thinking was only evil continually. That is a mouthful. The word wickedness is an important word. So if you have a translation that's got that word wickedness, I think it's an important word to understand the state of the world at this time. And the Lord, verse 6, and the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and he was, the Hebrew word is grieved at heart, the English says. The Hebrew, it's one word, and it means brokenhearted. The opposite of angry in terms of the emotional scale. Brokenhearted. And so the Lord said, "I will destroy, blot out, and wipe away mankind whom I have created from the face of the ground. Not only man, but the beasts and the creeping things and the birds of the air, because it grieves me and makes me regretful that I have made them all." But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. This is the history of the generations of Noah. Noah was a just and righteous man, blameless in his evil generation. So here's a culture that all of its thoughts and intentions are always and constantly evil. It's corrupt, it's putrid. And here's one guy who's just and blameless. And the secret of that is found in the end of this sentence in verse 9. Noah walked in habitual fellowship with God. That was the secret of Enoch. being a man who always pleased the Lord. He walked in fellowship with God. Noah became the father of three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. By the way, that happened when Noah was 500 years old. Noah became the father of three sons. Verse 11 says, the earth was depraved and putrid in God's sight. And the land was filled with violence, desecration, infringement, outrage, assault, and lust for power. Does that sound familiar? And God looked upon the world and saw how degenerate and debased and vicious it was, because all humanity had corrupted their way upon the earth and lost their true direction. Interesting that in all of that, the primary emotion that it mentions that God has is that he's heartbroken. So he's just going to wipe everybody out. He's going to wipe out all of creation because man was so polluted that he was polluting all of the pure creation that God gave him. I don't think we're that far away from that in the culture we live in. So God came to Noah and gave him some instructions, which I'm not going to read, about building the ark. Told him, gave him some detail, gave him all the proper dimensions, which I'm told by a naval architect were the perfect proportions of a seagoing vessel of that size. So God must have taken a class in naval architecture. That's all I can figure. Verse 17, after he tells them, you know, to make this huge ship 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet tall. Behold, verse 17. I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh under the heavens, in which are the breath and spirit of life. Everything that is on the land shall die, but I will establish my covenant, my promise, my pledge with you, and you shall come into the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Now, I just have to say one little thing. At this time, Noah didn't have any children. So it's kind of interesting. He didn't start having a family until 20 years after he started building the ark. Of every living thing, of all flesh found on land, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of fowls and birds according to their kinds, beasts according to their kinds, creeping things on the ground according to its kind, two of every sort shall come in with you that they may be kept alive. Also take with you every kind of food that is eaten. Collect it, store it. It shall serve as food for you and for them. Now here's the clincher, verse 22. Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him. So God looks with his heart of love. I'm amazed at how patient he is. He took Enoch out of the picture a couple of hundred years before this because things were so bad, and he just took Enoch home, and he still was patient, and then finally he comes to the end of his patience with humans, and he said, you know, the only kind and loving thing to do is just start over. Wipe everybody out. But you know what? There's one righteous guy. Can't wipe him out. So I'll start over with him and his family. God says, I'm going to, you know, it's beyond help. Every thought, every intention of humanity at this point in time is constantly evil. So I give you 120 more years. Which I've always just found remarkable. Why didn't he just grab Noah like he grabbed Enoch, his great grandpa? He still gave him another 120 years. I'm also find it interesting that Enoch, when he was alive, not that much earlier, most of the people that saw Noah's life would have seen Enoch's life. That's how long people lived in those days. Enoch warned people about judgment. The language of verse 1 or verse 2 here is 3, excuse me, is that God's spirit was striving, wrestling with humans, just like he does today. That's pretty bad when you hear warnings and God's spirit tugs at your heart and you blow it off and you blow it off. And finally, God just says, you know, there's got to be a limit to this. And he decides to destroy the world using water. The next time he does it, he's going to use fire. And when we get over to what Peter has to tell us and warn us about, we'll realize that we should learn a lesson that because God did it once, he still feels the same way about sin. And he's not above torching the whole thing. And, of course, we will be out of here when that happens. So let's flip back over to Hebrews chapter 11. I just wanted you to see the state of the world. I wanted you to see the state of God's heart, that he was heartbroken. He couldn't stand to see the damage people were doing to each other. He couldn't stand to see the effect that was having on the creation that he gave them to bless them. And God himself, after striving with them for hundreds of years, God himself, even after sending them someone to warn them, just said, that's it, I'm starting over. And then you see one guy standing out like a beacon, just like Enoch did. Enoch, remember, the Bible only speaks of two people that it describes as always pleasing God. Two people, Enoch and Jesus. That's a pretty exclusive group, I would think. And God just said to Enoch, come on, get out of here. I want you here with me. My brain is trying to find, because I've read as much as the Bible talks about Enoch's son Methuselah. Remember, that name means when this guy dies, the judgment comes. And Methuselah lived longer than any other human that had ever lived, and he died the year that the flood came. Interesting. He was also a contemporary of Noah, even though he was Noah's grandfather. So Methuselah, nothing special really said about him. Lamech, Noah's father, nothing really said special about him. But here along comes Noah, and it says he was a righteous man. He stood out in his wicked, evil generation because he was a godly man. And the secret for his being able to stick it out in a wicked generation was the same secret that Enoch was, and that is that he walked in close fellowship with God. I had you circle the word wicked there. I do want to say something about that. It comes into play later. When the Bible uses the word wicked, it's a distinct word, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. It means essentially to know what is right, to know what is wrong, to know the difference, and to deliberately and willfully choose what is wrong. Strong word. It's not people who don't know any better. It's not people who no one told them the rules so they didn't realize. It's not people whose circumstances have overwhelmed them and they just got caught having a really bad sin day. It's not that. It's people who know what's right, who know what's wrong. Remember, God said his spirit had been wrestling with them, and yet the earth was filled with wickedness. People who deliberately chose what is wrong, knowing what is right. Once again, I think there's some pretty amazing parallels with the world that we live in today. And evil tends to spread exponentially. And there was a point at which God said, that's it, that's enough. So Noah, by faith, Hebrews 11, verse 7, Noah, by faith, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, things never before ever seen, moved with godly fear. If you have a translation that just says fear, it would be really good to write in the word godly, because there are several different kinds of fear. Noah wasn't afraid of the flood. His reverence, his holy, godly fear was reverential fear. The Old Testament word and the New Testament word, both are often translated reverence. If you will, the fear of displeasing God and grieving him, not cringing kind of fear. So motivated by godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which faith, remember, by faith, Noah, by which faith he condemned the world, became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. I had to circle that word, condemned. Oh, I don't want to get ahead of myself. I'll give you the definition of it. It's a unique Greek word. I'm so glad I look words up, because I found things that were very confusing to me, and I looked the word up, and it just clears everything. But let's look at the Noah being divinely warned of things not yet seen. Genesis chapter 2 tells us that it had never rained on planet Earth until the flood. Never rained. Well, then, and also, even science today has discovered in mastodons, I read in one of the news magazines a week ago, discovered a small herd of mastodons frozen in the ice in Siberia. When they have done autopsies on their digestive tracts, they found tropical vegetation in their digestive systems. Lots of other fossil evidence tells us that the Earth, until the flood came, had a vapor canopy blanket surrounding it like Venus does, which would have made the whole Earth tropical. And it's why, they're just anomalies that are so baffling to people who will not allow the biblical record into their thinking. But until the flood came, vast underground reservoirs and this vapor canopy around the world, it didn't need to rain. The earth was lush and tropical in its temperature. And one of the reasons why people live so long is because of the thickness of the atmosphere filtered the cosmic radiation, which the particles that attack human bodies and cause the aging process. One of the reasons why people live so long. I personally think if you look at the record of creation in those first years when the human gene pool was pure, that God never intended for humans to have such short lives as we have now. They're pretty efficient bodies, but the fall of man affected all of creation in every single way. And nothing affected the creation even close to that until the flood. And then when the flood came, the vapor canopy surrounding the earth busted loose. It condensed, if I can use such a tame term for what happened. And it poured 40 days and 40 nights rain. But that's not where all the flooding came from. All those vast underground reservoirs busted loose. The Bible calls them in the King James Bible, the fountains of the deep broke loose. By the time the flood was over, water covered 25 feet over the tallest mountains that were then on the earth. An enormous amount of weight, which would have shifted continental plates, which would have thrust mountains up. I was just reading today that they have found sea creature fossils high up in the Himalayas. Which tell you that at one point those had to be underwater, and that you've just stopped to think about the geophysics of that much water covering the earth. Well, it had never rained before. God said, "I'm going to make it rain. I'm going to destroy the earth," and Noah believed that. And he not only believed that, but then he set about following God's instructions to build this boat with nothing of that size probably ever existed. There had to be boats because we know there were large bodies of water. It tells us that in Genesis chapter 1. But Noah worked 120 years. God says, okay, 120 years, I'm going to let everything loose and destroy the earth by water. And so Noah knew exactly how long it was going to be before destruction. I still find the dynamics of it interesting, because wouldn't you, after about 60 years, start wondering whether that was really the Lord that you heard? Especially if you're being mocked by your neighbors. People look at you like you're throwing your life away. You know, this wacko that has this 450-foot-long structure in his driveway. Wouldn't you start to doubt that? Well, first of all, if you were the kind of person that could doubt that, God couldn't have got through to you to begin with. And this is something that Wayne and I were talking about this on Sunday. You study the Old Testament patriarchs that answered what next time we'll look at Abraham. And Abraham just left everything and relocated to a place that God said, I'll show you when you get there. Left everything. And you think, how could those guys hear so clearly when it's hard for me to hear? Well, there's one really simple reason, and that's distraction. We have so much input going into our brains. It's hard in our culture to even achieve 5 minutes of total silence. And C.S. Lewis said, even when we can shut up outwardly, our inside's still chattering away. We've just got constant input. One of the characteristics that you'll notice of people that God got through to them to do extraordinary things is they were people that number one priority in their life was time spent with God. And I think it's just as simple as that. Why doesn't God talk to me that way? Well, maybe he would like to, but maybe he doesn't have any space. Maybe there's so much other input, he doesn't have the freedom. He doesn't have the open space. He doesn't have the, I think I can work in for about 45 minutes the next Thursday. Well, no, wait a minute, I'm sorry. Maybe, what about the Thursday after that? You know, that's just the way that our modern brains are. So here's a guy who walked uprightly despite a constantly wicked culture surrounding him. He's the only guy. So when God comes along and says, you know, I got to put humans out of their misery. I'm going to start over again. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to build a boat. You know, he's right there. I mean, he's had good enough fellowship with God all of his whole life that it's easy for him to understand. I still think it was such an enormous undertaking. It was so costly. He had to furnish his own resources. Costly. I mean, he did start building the ark when he was 480 years old. But, you know, if you look at how long he lived and you do the math, that would be about 40 years old in our life. And it's still a long project. And it's no wonder after doing it for 20 years, he said, you know, I need help. So he'd started having kids, and he had 3 sons, and they had plenty of time to grow up to where they could help him. Never happened before. He was warned by God, and by faith, by simply believing what God said, he prepared an ark. That word prepared it's a very comprehensive word. It means he shaved the timbers. He did the mortises and the tenons, you know, he went and cut the wood. I mean, he did everything that was necessary. No wonder it took him 120 years, even if he did get help from his sons later. Here's what one of my commentators said about this. This is, I think, an important principle in Hebrews chapter 11, is that real faith will always do something. Remember James said, when he said, if you say that you have faith, but it does not produce some kind of an action in your life. If you say you believe God, but you don't act on that, it's dead. It's not living faith at all. Faith is highly connected to obedience, which is why I find it so baffling to people who look me right in the eyes and tell me, yes, I believe in God, I have faith in God, and yet they have no interest whatsoever in obeying him. They're pretty much going to do what they want to do. And I said, well, then you don't have faith in God. It's not real faith. So it was why he's listed here as in the Hall of Fame of faith, so to speak. Remember in verse 1, it says faith is the conviction of things not seen. He was positive that God was going to do what God said he was going to do, even though it had never been done on planet Earth ever before. And he was so sure of it, he was willing to start on the project and carry it out to its completion. I love the end of Genesis 6 where it says, and Noah did everything just like God told him. That's what real faith is. And I have to tell you, Jesus said, and I think it was one of the most pathetic things that he said. It makes me sad every time I read it. He said, when the Son of Man returns, will he find any faith on the earth? Is he going to find anybody that actually takes him at his word enough to obey him and live their lives for him? And if you look at the world that Noah came in, there was only one guy. That's pretty remarkable. I do find it interesting that God knew right where he was because God hung out with him all the time. So he prepared an ark. Real faith is always going to do something. Now, it's obvious to embark on a project for 120 years of your life, despite being misunderstood and mocked by your contemporaries, throwing away all of your resources for something just because somebody that you think is God told you to do it, and he's going to bring something about that's never happened before. There's no precedent for it. How you would look to your contemporaries, you can understand why this example would be so important to the Hebrew Christians who were ostracized. Some of them suffered. They couldn't do business in Jerusalem anymore once they gave themselves to Jesus. Their families had funerals for them. They lost their friends. They lost the respect. Remember, the view of a Hebrew Christian in Jerusalem was that you'd abandoned God. You weren't commended for that. You were looked at as you were at best crazy and at worst a heretic. So it was costly to them. So the writer of Hebrews is just pointing back into their history and say, you know, if that's the way you feel in your culture, you're in good company. Because every one of these great men and women in your history faced the same kind of thing. They stood out from the crowd. They obeyed God. And so I can see why that would be important for them. One of the things I thought about yesterday when I was studying this was that during the period of time that Noah built the ark, started building the ark when he was about 480 years old, and God told him to start, Earth has 120 years left. And then the destruction comes. And the flood came when Noah was 600 years old. So you do the math, that's 120 years. He had his three sons when he was 500 years old. So that means 20 years into his project, he decided to have a family. And it's interesting to me because last night when we were talking about this in Rockland, Julia said, well, he needed help. So he decided to have some babies. And I thought, well, I guess that's, guys used to do that in our history. You know, you wanted to have, you needed help on the farm. So you had hoped you had a bunch of sons. I don't know why he did, if that was the reason. But I do find it interesting that in the face of impending judgment, it didn't compromise his righteousness to raise a family. It didn't distract him from his job. to raise a family. It's all about priorities, isn't it? Priorities, that by definition, are the proper arrangement in order of importance. So he was able to do what God told him to do, still raise a family, sons that were godly enough that picked women that eventually God rescued all eight people. Peter tells us the thing we learn from that is that God knows how to rescue the righteous when he brings destruction on the wicked. So it says a lot about what kind of a guy Noah was and what kind of a woman Mrs. Noah was. But I do find it interesting because I have people, whenever I teach on the end times, which I'm absolutely convinced that we are in, and we don't know how long we have. We might have 120 minutes. We might have 120 days. I don't think Earth has another 120 years. I can't see how that's even possible. But when you talk to people about it, one of the first things they say is, well, then why should I go to college? You know, or what's the point in even hoping God sends me a husband? Or why should we have babies? And of course, that's not really the issue. This is a guy who walked with God, constantly in fellowship with God. So, of course, he did know he had 120 years. But apparently, it didn't sacrifice his ability to do his job by having a family. And I think that's a ponderable thing, don't you think? By which faith, moved with godly fear, he condemned the world. Had to circle that word, condemned. Notice it was his faith in action that condemned the world. Here's the word for condemned if you're writing these things down. It's a unique word. Never have run into it before in all the New Testament. It is the word katakrino, K-A-T-A-K-R-I-N-O, katakrino. It's a compound word. Here's what it says. It means by one's good example to make another's wickedness more evident. Is that interesting? I wanted to read you what two commentators said, Charles Spurgeon and then another guy from Germany that I really like. Because he correctly defines this word katakrino as mean it was not what Noah said, it was the way he lived his life that exposed the wickedness of the world around him. Here's what he says. We shouldn't think that Noah was a man who preached sermons of condemnation to the world. Instead, the mere conduct of a godly person without any preaching at all will expose wickedness. And of course, that's where a lot of persecution comes from. You can be persecuted just because you're a poop head, you know, just because you're mean and you're nasty and you should keep your mouth shut and you don't know how to do that. And you just, you know, you're just in people's face and they persecute you for that. But it's possible that if you just live a righteous life, it's going to bug people. And that's the way it was with Noah. There's an interesting phrase in the scripture we're going to read when I get to it soon. In 2 Peter chapter 2, Peter says Noah was a preacher of righteousness. Notice, not a preacher of judgment. I'm sure he had to have been noticed what he was doing, and that when people came and talked to him, he had to have told them about judgment. We know Enoch did. Jude, the book of Jude tells us that Enoch warned people of God's judgment. But here's what, so I looked this word preacher up. I'm so glad I did. Because I thought, well, wait a minute. He's preaching righteousness and he's not warning anybody? Listen to what the word for preacher is here. It's the word kerex, K-E-R-Y-X. It means an ambassador who proclaims someone's message. So God's message was, destruction is coming. Said it through Enoch. But he was he was a proclaimer of righteousness. He was God's representative. He was God's message in a human life who lived a righteous life. Let me read you what Charles Spurgeon says about that. I cannot find anywhere that Noah ever entered into any arguments with the men of his time. He never argued or disputed, much less did he wish them ill. He simply believed God. He told them the truth. He kept his own faith intact and went on building his ark, thus practicing what he believed. And it was in this way that he condemned those who criticized him. You wonder, you know, I find this so penetrating because do I live, practice what I believe? So that is it, it's one thing to preach at people and tell them they're sinners and tell them what the right thing to do. It's another thing if your life tells them what righteousness is. So his preaching condemned them. They knew the way, and they wickedly refused to walk in it. That's the very definition God gave him of being wicked. And his warning condemned them because they wouldn't pay attention and escape. There would have been plenty of room in the ark. His life condemned them because he walked with the God whom they despised. And the ark even condemned them. So God warned them through Enoch. God's spirit was wrestling with them. And yet they still chose evil. God was brokenhearted. This is not God who just flies off the handle and says, that's it, I'm just wiping everybody out. That's the picture I always had of the flood. I'm seeing it differently. After looking at the details. Genesis 6:9 says that Noah was just and righteous in a wicked generation. He walked with God in close fellowship, and apparently he did that his whole life. For 120 years of that life, he constructed the ark. Here's something God spoke to me, really encouraged me. I'm a math head. So I'm trying to figure out all the numbers in this, and I figure out Noah lived to be over 900 years old, but he started the ark when he was 480. He finished the ark, and the flood started when he was 600. So there's 120 years, do the math, divide 120 into 600, and you realize that one-fifth of his life was devoted to this one thing that God told him to do. He had to wait till he was 480 years old before God gave it to him to do. So you do the math. I did it on my little calculator. One-fifth of his life, when did he start? You know, how would that translate itself out to me and my life? And I came up with an amazing thing. I have spent one-fifth of my life being the pastor of this church. Now, it's interesting that Noah, for 120 years, which is a long time, even if it's only one-fifth of your life, that's a long time. One-fifth of his life doing what God told him to do, and essentially nobody was saved except his family. And I was thinking of that, and I thought, I've given one-fifth of my life to pastor in this church. Yeah, it's small, and yes, it is shrinking, and I have lost a lot of people, but you know what? I way surpassed the number of people that got saved under Noah's ministry. So I just feel pretty good about that. I just thought, wow, it's all about perspective, isn't it? It takes honest to goodness, faith, and obedience to devote yourself to something long-term, because you know that God told you to do it. And that is the point the writer of Hebrews is trying to make to these people. He said over and over, you are not going to inherit the promise that God has for you if you give up. You just need to hang out in there. Here, I'll give you some examples. And then in chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, he says, okay, you've got all these examples around you of people that said, yes, it's worth trusting God. And you look, and you saw what happened in their lives. And he says, okay, hold that in your mind while you're running your race. So, little shifting of gears. Because Jesus used Noah in a warning that he gave in Matthew 24 when Jesus talked about birth pains, the signs of the end of the age, which I believe we are living in right now. Remember the birth pains? And the whole thing he talked about is when they increase in their frequency and they increase in their intensity, you know, the birth is about to happen. He said, hold that picture, because that's the way these things I'm going to tell you about, when they increase in their frequency and their intensity, you know, the end is coming. Your rescue, your deliverance is coming. And one of the things Jesus said in that speech, found in Matthew 24, verses 37, 38, 39. I'll read it for you. When the Son of Man returns, it will be just like it was in Noah's day. In those days before the flood, people were enjoying banquets and parties and weddings right up to the day that Noah entered his boat. The people didn't realize what was going to happen until the flood came and swept them all of the way out of the way. That is the way it will be when the Son of Man comes. And those are sobering words, because the whole point Jesus was making, of course, now we know the story, is that God's Spirit had been striving with people, just like Jesus said the Spirit of God is in the world to convince people of sin. Remember? We looked at that a couple weeks ago in John. Enoch had warned them. Here's a guy building, had to be one of the wonders of the world in those days. 120 years of a testimony and a witness of what righteousness was in human life. And they're having their parties. And I've always found the phrase they were having weddings, right, for the day Noah went in. But that shows you how clueless they were as to how short time was. It's just going to all go on like this forever. Don't pay attention to old man Wacko out there building the 450-foot boat in his driveway. Jesus said, watch carefully, look at Noah carefully, because that's exactly what the world is going to be like when I return. Because of the tornadoes that happened this last week, you know, everybody wanted to talk about end times signs and, you know, labor pains and stuff, but you know, the Bible doesn't say anything about tornadoes at all. I mean, it's true. We have more bizarre weather now than in any recorded history. But if you look at the few things that Jesus said were labor pains, famines, earthquakes, and pestilence. Pestilence means out of control diseases, killing massive numbers of people, and they're out of control. They can't be controlled. Greater famine in the last few years than in all of human history. More earthquakes in the last 10 years than in all of recorded history combined. More killer earthquakes. Earthquakes above 6.5 on the Richter scale. You know, unless it just wipes out a whole country, people don't even pay attention to it anymore. That's over there. That's someplace else. Jesus said, when you see those things begin to happen, you that are going to be alive during that period of time, lift up your eyes, because your redemption is near. Listen to what Peter says about it. 2 Peter chapter 2, he said, God spared not the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven other people, when he brought a flood upon the world of ungodly people, the ungodly. Look that word up. You know what that means? It means people who know there's a God and who despise him and ignore him. Sounds a lot like wicked, doesn't it? Okay, now I just want to read you the application of it in 2 Peter chapter 3. Because I think obviously there was an application. We talked about it to the people in Hebrews. I mean, there's a lesson we can just learn about being obedient, staying in close fellowship to God so he can tell you what he wants you to do, and then trust him enough to give your life to it and to stay at it until you're done. And the reward that comes from that, that's the application in Hebrews 11. But we have a unique application that they didn't have because of the days that we live in. So listen to what Peter says, 2 Peter 3. He's talking about the Lord's promise that he was going to return. 2 Peter 3:3 says, to begin with, you have to understand this. Scoffers, mockers, will come in the last days with scoffing. In other words, they're going to come scoffing. It's not like they come and then they just can't believe the evidence. It's they've already made up their mind before they even get there. People who walk after their own fleshly desires, and they're going to say, where is the promise of his coming? Ever since our forefathers fell asleep, everything has continued exactly as it did from the beginning of creation. And Peter says, but they are willfully overlook and forget this fact. The heavens came into existence long ago by the word of God, and the earth also, which was formed out of water by means of water, through which water the world that then existed was flooded and perished. But, he said, they overlooked that fact. They've just completely ignored the fact of the flood. There's plenty of geological evidence. There are pictures of a huge boat sticking out of the glacier on Mount Ararat over the 13,000-foot level. Impossible for a bunch of Sherpas to carry that much wood up there and constructed it up there. But no, I don't want to get off on that. I'm not teaching Genesis tonight. Willfully forget and overlook that God flooded the world. Verse 7 says, by the same word that created, the same word that brought the judgment, by the same word, the present heavens and earth have been stored up and reserved for fire. Of course, the first time that God destroyed the flood, he just radically remodeled the earth. He saved some humans. He saved some animals to start over with. The Bible says that, and we'll listen to what he says about the judgment that's coming by fire. Reserved for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and the destruction of ungodly people. Once again, people who despise God. Nevertheless, don't let this one fact escape you, beloved, that with the Lord one day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like one day. The Lord does not delay and is not slow or late about what he promises, according to some people's conception of slowness. But he is long-suffering, extraordinarily patient toward you, not desiring that any should perish, but that all should turn to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief. And then the heavens, in other words, unexpectedly for some people, like a thief. And then the heavens will vanish with a thunderous crash, and the material elements of the universe will be dissolved with fire. Can you imagine before the invention of nuclear weapons, how anybody could wrap their brain around that? You would just think it's figurative language, wouldn't you? Except that's exactly what happens. The elements themselves dissolve, and the earth and the works that are up on it will be burned up. Here's the kicker. 2 Peter 3:11. Since all of these things are thus in the process of being dissolved, what kind of people ought each of you to be in the meanwhile? You ought to be consecrated and holy, devout with behavior and godly qualities, looking for and hastening his coming. So Jesus points at the days of Noah and says, look at that closely. Look at the way the world was. Because it's going to be just like that in the final day. And what Peter is saying is that destruction was thorough. But it's not as thorough as the coming destruction by fire is going to be. And I've always found that phrase in verse 11 of 2 Peter 3 so poignant. If that's what's going to happen, and if we're on the verge of it, what kind of people ought you to be? Well, I would think certainly not materialistic people. I wouldn't think you would want to be investing yourself in stuff that could be snuffed like that, and that will be. Jesus said it in a different way. He says, where your treasure is where your heart's going to be. And he said that so that we wouldn't invest our hearts in stuff that could be stolen or burned down or ultimately, like Peter says, be totally destroyed. So I think we look at Noah. That's why I wanted to read through chapter 6 of Genesis. And I wanted for us to look at what the world was like, because Jesus said, "In right before I come to get my church, that's what the world is going to be like. Same characteristics. In that era, there was only one righteous guy. Enoch escaped a couple of hundred years earlier. I've always found that intriguing. Does that mean Enoch was more righteous than Noah? I don't know, because Noah basically had to live longer in that crummy, stinky world. But God did start over and use him. And don't know. I just find it interesting that there was anybody living a righteous life. And I look at that and I look at Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, and I look at my own life and I think, man, I want to be running the race that God gave me to run. I have to tell you that what I've been doing for 1/5 of my life is the most discouraging thing I've ever done in my whole life. Fewer visible results for the kingdom than anything that I've ever done, and most of what I've done for my life. But I was really cheered up when I did the math on Noah's life and realized 1/5 of his life and nobody was saved. He did squeak his family in. That means he wasn't a total failure. There were people close to him that were rescued. So it's just inspiration to me to stay at what God's given you to do. We talked last night about Mrs. Noah. She was rescued also. Did she help with the ark? I don't know. Maybe the first 20 years she did. She probably didn't after she started having babies and raised a family. So was she doing what God told her to do? Absolutely. And that was responsible for those people being rescued. You think you have to raise your kids in a crummy environment? What if you're the only righteous family on the face of the earth? And they still are righteous enough to be rescued. I just find these are all really ponderable things to me. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things that hadn't happened ever, moved by reverence for God, spent 120 years building an ark. And the way he lived his life, preacher of righteousness, the way he lived his, not a preacher of judgment, preacher of righteousness, by his life saying, this is what God intended humans, the way he intended them to live. I'm taking them seriously. Don't know about you. My faith is intact. I'm going to keep working on my boat. You can call me crazy if you want to. And of course, God vindicated that life and he was rescued. And I look at that and see the example and think, man, in the smaller proportions of my life, maybe the smaller proportions of your neighborhood or your household, I just find it intriguing that God called this one guy to live a life like this, knowing that nobody was going to be rescued, and God still gave him an example and he still warned him. I've been reading for when Ezekiel was called and Jeremiah was called and Isaiah was called, these heavyweight prophets. And when all three of them were called, God spoke to them and said, here's what I want you to say. I want you to say it your whole life until I tell you otherwise. And by the way, nobody's going to listen to you. And I put myself in their place. A little bit I know what that feels like, except there are people who do listen to me. So, and even that gets discouraging because there aren't a lot of them. But what God always does when I'm thinking that way is he says, Bob, you're missing the point, son. The point that you're missing is how I feel about people who are lost. I want them to be warned. I want them to see a life that's lived in righteousness. Even though I know they're not going to pay attention, I still want them to see it. That's an amazing heart of love. Don't you think God would just say, that's it? When you go all the way back to Genesis 6, verse 1, and God said, the world stinks, it's putrid. Every thought and inclination of human brains is nothing but evil. That's it. You got 5 minutes. You know, wouldn't you think? God says, no, I'll give you 120 more years. And better than that, I'll give you a guy. I'll give you the best guy on earth to live out his life in obedience. He's going to do something that's so bizarre, it's going to draw everybody's attention. And it will be a fabulous object lesson and warning if anybody pays attention. And I just think God's heart is so amazing. And I read that, and then, of course, then I just feel angry at myself that I don't feel about lost people the way that God does. I tell you, sometimes when they're in my face, I just want to go, man, God, get me out of here and torch this place. And the Lord says, son, you know, when you're thinking like that, you don't know what spirit you're of. That's just not the way I feel. Yeah, he is going to judge. He wants to rescue people. So, don't know about you, but I'm inspired by Noah in a number of ways. I'm inspired to have the kind of faith that obeys. Even if God asks me to do something that's never been done before. And I'm inspired to be the kind of guy he can do that for because I'm the kind of guy that's walking in close fellowship with him my whole life. I was telling Mark before the study, I have a devotional that Carol gave me, written by Henry Blackaby. And boy, he's been knocking him out of the ballpark this last couple of weeks, every single day. But on the cover, it says, if you are walking in close fellowship with God today, you are going to be in the center of God's will tomorrow. If that's the way you're living your life, when it comes to tomorrow and you're doing that, you're going to be exactly where God wants you to be. Isn't it odd? We're asking God, show me your will, show me your will, show me your will. And he says, yeah, well, I have actually. My will is that you're just in close fellowship with me one day at a time, constantly, and I'll know where to reach you if I have anything special to tell you to do. And that narrows our focus. So I was telling Mark before, the way that you can tell how important of a priority that is in your life is purpose to do it. Say, I am going to make walking in close fellowship with God and listening to God first place in my life, and then just watch all hell break loose in resistance to that, in opposition to that. And we have it easy. We have a couple of million Christians on this planet. Noah was the only one. Eventually, he had a family, but he sort of had to build it himself. And he was able to rescue. 8 people were rescued in all out of the whole population of the world of several billion people. So I'm inspired to be faithful. It matters. I've already feel better about myself that I have a way better, higher proportion of people got saved in 1/5 of my life than he did. So, gee, I feel like Billy Graham by comparison, you know? But I'm also inspired by that story to take Jesus at his word and to take Peter at his word that, you know what, if I look very closely at the world I live in right now, the time is short. What kind of a person I ought to be? I ought to be living a godly life. I ought to be attentive, blooming where he's planted me. And so good stuff, huh? That's one verse of Hebrews chapter 11. Next week is worship and prayer. But next time after that, we'll start looking at Abraham. And boy, there's a guy. You know, just a little hors d'oeuvre about Abraham. He's a guy who is, again, the only guy in the midst of a totally ungodly culture that God will even speak to. And God says, pack up everything and split and go someplace where I'll tell you and I'll give you the whole place. And he does. He doesn't do it perfectly. He gets distracted and detoured a few times. But when his story is recorded in history in Hebrews 11, he's a guy that just did everything God told him to do and never wavered. And see, that's because what he did in faith was remembered, and his sins were forgiven and forgotten. And I love looking at Abraham. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this example. I know I did not do justice to it. I am grateful that you saw fit to, that the words about the days of Noah were included in our warning, the signs of the times that we live in. Because it is a very sobering to look and see the same parallels and to realize judgment is just around the corner and our deliverance is just around the corner. And we want to see people rescued along with us. Lord, I thank you for the application of this whole book of Hebrews, of being people who don't give up so that we can actually receive the promise you want to give us. And the thing that keeps us going is simply to trust you, to just live lives that trust you, despite the evidence. So help us, Lord, to be that kind of people in practical, everyday ways. I thank you that I have people in my life that live their lives that way. I thank you for the inspiration, Lord, they are to me. I pray I could be that for others. Teach us how this fits, Lord, today in our lives, we pray. Amen.